Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
I mentioned a Conor McGregor sighting. All right, so he appears last night on Jimmy Fallon. It was in a pre-taped interview. In the interview, good news, Conor said that he was in the process of negotiating for a July fight. Very good news. And then hours after the interview aired on the East Coast, and before it aired out here, Conor tweets the following, quote, "Hey guys, quick announcement. I have decided to retire from the sport formerly known as mixed martial art today. I wish all my colleagues well going forward in competition. I now join my former partners on this venture, already in retirement. Proper pina coladas on me, fellas." End quote. Oh, damn. Holy crap. Conor is retiring. Conor McGregor is retiring. Yeah, okay. I guess. Whatever. I mean, shocking. That is, if anybody really believes that this guy's retiring. Because it's not the first time that he is, quote, retired on social. I'm pretty certain it's not going to be the last time either. Because nothing about this feels like a retirement. Starting with the fact that only hours earlier, he was on TV talking about having a fight this summer. And then you have the fact that he tweeted it out. The announcement, the retirement announcement, he put it out in a tweet at 1:18 in the morning on the East Coast. And again, he's done this before. It's not the first time. Remember that April of 2016 retirement announcement? Quote, "I've decided to retire young. Thanks for the cheese. Catch yous later." And then that retirement was because Dana White wanted him at a press conference in Las Vegas to promote his rematch with Nate Diaz. And after they got that resolved, he unretired, he came back to beat Diaz, and he beat Eddie Alvarez, and he became the double champ. And then he boxed Floyd Mayweather. And then he lost to Khabib. And he made a crap load of money along the way. With crap loads of money still out there, all he has to do is show up and pick it up. Like that tweet back in 2016. That sounded like Conor, even if it wasn't real. But that one last night does not sound like Conor at all. Starting with a tweet that reads, "Hey guys, quick announcement." I mean, does that sound like something Conor McGregor would say? "Hey guys, quick announcement." It sounds more like something that somebody would say if they want to get the staff together in a small company in the conference room. "Hey guys, quick announcement. Listen, stop throwing trash into the recycling bin next to the copier. When you do that, Doug, who takes out the recycling, thank you, Doug, has to sort it out by himself. Okay, everybody, back to work. And remember, the company picnic is Saturday. Hey, everybody, quick announcement." Yeah, also, he referred to it as the sport formerly known as mixed martial art. Pretty weird. But you know what the weirdest part of all was? Conor McGregor shouting out to guys and saying the pina coladas are on him. I mean, why not just go full-on whiskey plug right there? If the guy's going to retire from mixed martial art, he's going to go into the business full-time of whiskey. So why is he hyping pina coladas for everybody? So what about Dana White? What was Dana White's reaction to the latest retirement? Dana White told Kevin Ioli of Yahoo, quote, "He has the money to retire, and his whiskey is killing it. It totally makes sense. If I were him, I would retire too. He's retiring from fighting, not from working. The whiskey will keep him busy, and I'm sure he has other things he's working on. He has been so fun to watch. He has accomplished incredible things in this sport. I'm so happy for him. I look forward to seeing him be as successful outside the octagon as he was in it." End quote. All right, so Dana's interesting, right? As always. Do you think that Dana believes him, or is Dana calling his bluff? Dana has made the point on this very show numerous times that Conor has made so much money that he doesn't need to keep fighting and that he could and should retire at some point. So does that mean that Dana thinks this is real? Or is it Dana just saying what he said to Yahoo to cover in the event that it's real? Is he calling Conor's bluff and acting like the promotion can and will just move on without him? And is Conor really retiring, or is he just pissed at how his latest negotiation's going. Just pissed because Dana won't let him headline the event. I know this. What I don't get from Dana is the feeling of, wow, this is the end of a great career. In fact, I don't think that anybody gets that from this. Conor is 30. He has a number of years of retiring and unretiring left if he wants to. I mean, getting punched in the face, kicked in the head, and choked out is not the easiest way to make a living. But this guy's one of the best to ever do it. And there's still crazy, crazy Jack out there for him. And sure, he's probably set for life already. But I've got a hard time believing that Conor McGregor is going to leave all those stacks and stacks and stacks on the table. Which is why I have a really hard time buying this really weird tweet. Here's what I do know. Dana White is not pushing Conor out. Conor might be annoying at times. Conor might be a hassle. But Conor makes money. Lots of money. The fight with Khabib was 2.5 million pay-per-view buys. That's a company record. The boxing match with Floyd Mayweather, 4.4 mil. Second largest pay-per-view event in history. In other words, Conor's act may be a little bit tedious, but Dana's not going to rush him out the door. Not when he's making that kind of money for himself and the company. If you're not a fan, that's cool. But if you want to dump on this guy and say that Dana would be better off without this guy, that's just wrong. Because he sells fights better than anybody ever has. But here's the bigger problem. The bigger problem. When Conor, quote, retired the first time, that was big news. Everybody freaked out. Except this time, the reaction is not nearly as big, and people aren't freaking out. One, because it has happened. Two, because some of the luster is gone. What is Conor known for now? Getting arrested and retiring. He's not known for fighting, at least not in the cage. He's known for fighting vans. He's known for fighting people who want his photo, allegedly. Every headline Conor has made recently has been for something other than fighting somebody in the cage. In other words, my man is in danger of becoming a sideshow. I can't believe I'm saying this about a guy who was the most electric athlete on the planet not that long ago. But he is lurching towards that at a rapid rate. I don't have a problem with him losing to Khabib. Everybody knew he was in deep, and I totally respect that he took on that challenge. But everything that has happened since then has been a bad look. Does anybody really think that Conor is done for good? I mean, come on. That he's leaving the sport formerly known as mixed martial art with a loss to Khabib and a tweet at 1 o'clock in the morning? Does anybody really think he's going to walk away from making stacks of cash and become a legend and being a legend to just becoming a whiskey maker? Doubt that. Bottom line, if that tweet is the end, that is a bad ending. And if it's not, it's just a bad look. This book is called Inside the Empire, The True Power Behind the New York Yankees. The book is out today. The author is a best-selling author. Paul Solotaroff is my guest. Paul, it's nice to have you back. How are you?
Jim, long time no talk.
Long time no talk.
I think I did the NFL concussion scandal piece. On your show, I think I did the James Harrison piece, maybe Aaron Hernandez. Good Lord, we go back.
Hey, Paul, no maybe about that. We absolutely did the Aaron Hernandez piece on this show, and we do go back. So let me ask you about your latest project, the project on the Yankees. How did that come to be, and what was it, Paul, that got you interested in this?
So my co-writer, Bob Clappish, and I knew in the summer of 2016 when Cash pulled off those deals for Chapman, for Andrew Miller, that there was a super team forming on the horizon. But we thought its ETA was 2019, not 2018. And of course, idiots that we are, turned out to be 2017, because Judge, Sanchez, Sebi, Betances all arrived a year or two early. And so come the end of the 17 season, we looked at each other and said, oh my God. And then of course, Cashman goes out and absolutely crushes Jeter in the Giancarlo Stanton deal, and we had to get busy a year early. So here we are, and what we didn't know, and had no way of knowing, was how badly Brian Cashman had been waiting for someone to come along and finally ask him the right questions about him and Jeter, about him and Joe Torre, and about him and Joe Girardi, because he was ready to spit fire, and he did.
No matter how big or small your team is, Ferguson has a winning game plan for pro contractors. With thousands of plumbing repair parts, knowledgeable associates, and the largest national footprint in the game, when the pressure is on, you can all count on Ferguson. Paul Solotaroff joining us. All right, Paul, there's so much to unpack right there and so many questions. Let me start with Jeter. Based on your research, how would you describe the relationship between Cashman and Derek Jeter, and why is it that way?
Sort of like the relationship right now between Adam Schiff and Donald Trump. It ain't good. They fell out in 2010 and have barely spoken since. The story we unpack in this book is that last contract negotiation of Jeter's, he wanted 6 years, $25 million a year, which would have made him far and away the highest paid player in baseball, despite the fact that he was done. Played four more years. Arguably, he earned those honorarium years, but he was not even a replacement value shortstop as of 2010. He comes in making his demand. Cashman says, look, we'll pay you for those four titles. We'll give you 3 years at 17 for a total of 51. Jeter explodes. Cash says, fine, go out and shop the deal. If you can beat it, bring the deal back, we'll match. Jeter comes back tail between legs with his agent, Casey Close, and he got nowhere near, didn't even get within a sniff of the 51 mil. He says, all right, I'll take the 51 mil if you give me a piece of the team. And Cashman and the other Yankee executives at the bargaining table just laugh. And he goes, Jeter says, well, which shortstop would you rather have playing at Yankee Stadium? And Cashman gets to five before Jeter stands up in tears and runs out of the room saying, that's it. I don't want to play anywhere else, but I can't be in this room another minute.
Holy crap, Paul. Paul Solotaroff joining us. It's an absolutely amazing story. All right, so I could keep following you on Jeter, but I got to get some other topics out there. What about Joe Girardi? One of the things that you get into is why Joe Girardi is no longer the manager of the Yankees. And as you started digging into that topic, when did things start to go south between Girardi and the front office, and in particular, Cashman?
2012? Mm-hmm. 2013? Joe Girardi was a reaction decision to Joe Torre. Joe Torre had stopped managing around 2004. He stuck around through the end of 2007. Cashman saved his job multiple times with George. But finally, you know, Joe asked for the sun, moon, and stars in his contract negotiations after the 07 season. We go deep into that. It was an ugly, ugly parting between Torre and the Yankees. And then, of course, Torre turns around and backstabs Brian Cashman in his book, The Yankee Years. So Cashman wanted the opposite of Torre. If Torre was the good dad, Cashman wanted the tough dad. And the tough dad was an effective play for 3-4 years. And then the kids that started to filter up from their AAA system got one look at this guy, this New Jersey state trooper, and said, hell to the no. And they began sending word up that they wanted no parts of this guy. Now, he was done for shizzle August of 17. Something happened with Sanchez. Something happened on the back pages of the Post. End of subject. But, you know, he had that, went on that run. That team came within a brilliantly pitched Charlie Morton game seven in the ALCS of sending the Yankees onto the World Series. It didn't happen, and people think if Joe had managed them to and through the World Series, he would have been rehired. No chance. And so Boone then becomes a reaction formation to Girardi. Boone is not the good dad, the bad dad. He's the cool dad. He's the guy that comes in, relates to all his boys, plays video games with them, knows all the reggaeton tunes, spends a minute and a half with each of his players at their locker, the exact right amount of time before each game. And that's great. It's wonderful. It'll get you smoothly from April through end of September. But as we saw in the four-game sweep by the Red Sox last August when Alex Cora lost his mind because Severino almost drilled Mookie Betts in retaliation for Gardner being hit. Cora came screaming out of the dugout like a flaming arrow and stood in the on-base circle cursing Aaron Boone. And by the way, they're good friends. And Boone said nothing. And boy, did that cost him with his team. All in the book.
This book is called Inside the Empire, The True Power Behind the New York Yankees. The book is out today. The author is a best-selling author. Paul Solotaroff is my guest. Paul, let's double back. Let's talk Brian Cashman for another moment or so. He's had this amazing run in the sense that he's been the GM of the Yankees for more than 20 years. Never mind, Paul, the number of rings they've won. To be able to survive in that job, in that market, with that pressure for two decades is amazing. But take me all the way back. What was the perception of him when he first arrived with the Yankees?
So he was largely seen as the substitute teacher. And that perception of him has never really changed in New York because he hugs the back of the wall in the press room, not the front, because he almost never speaks for attribution unless someone's blasting him. Then he retaliates. He's told us he hasn't read this book because there's so much admiring stuff about him in this. He is, as we go to great lengths to document, the most powerful man in baseball right now. And whoever is number two is not in his rearview mirror. It ain't Rob Manfred. Rob Manfred serves at the pleasure of 30 owners. Brian Cashman serves the pleasure of one man, Hal Steinbrenner, and he has taken that team from $800 million value to total of $9 billion in value between the value of the franchise and the value of its TV station. Yes, $9 billion. And the story we go on to tell is not just how Cashman grew the brand, but how the business guy in the Yankees, Randy Levine, reveals all these deep secrets. For instance, what did George pay for the team in 1973? They showed me the original bill of sale and the canceled check. It wasn't $8.8 million. It wasn't $800,000. It was $80,000. George got a controlling interest of the New York Yankees for $80,000.
Wow.
Anyway, we double back with Randy because in 98, George had sold the team to Jim and Chuck Dolan. He had sold the team to two of the biggest schmucks in all of sports. And, well, certainly the biggest schmuck in all of sports in Jim Dolan. And Jim Dolan took this enormous gift horse and spat at it. He threw a tantrum, essentially demanded his father back out of the deal. They backed out of the deal instead of owning what is now $9 billion in asset value. He got $30 million in a settlement for the Yankees to get out of their media deal with MSG, and he used the $30 million to build the practice facility for his Knicks and Rangers. That's how shrewd a businessman Jim Dolan
is. Schmucks. Paul Solotaroff is joining us. Paul, one more thought about George Steinbrenner. For those who do not remember, what was it like to be Brian Cashman and working with George back in the day? What was a normal day like for Cash, and how did that day start?
So everyone thinks that Cashman just stood there and took it off of George. But we talked to three of Cashman's most veteran colleagues, and they said he screamed right back at George. And the only people George ever respected, Randy Levine, Lon Trost, et cetera, gave it back to him in spades. It's funny. You know, I wrote the cover story about Trump on the campaign trail 3 years ago, and he told me he modeled himself after George, except that George knew how to close the deal. And George knew when he was dealing with someone who was really gifted. And Cashman was really gifted. But he tells, here's an example. They win everything in 98, arguably the best team in the history of baseball, 125 wins. And they have the big parade, and they show up at City Hall to get on the floats. And George is screaming mad because the players have brought their wives. How dare they bring their blankety-blank wives and try and put them on the floats? If anything, they're going to ride in the bus behind the floats. And he's screaming at John Wetland, and he's screaming at Jim Leyritz, and he's screaming. And the wives stand up to George and say, no, damn it, we're getting on those floats. And Cashman said to himself, that was the end of his first year as GM. He thought, oh, my God, this is George on the best day of his life. I'm in for misery.
It's amazing. All right, so, Paul, last thought. From all the research you did, what surprised you the most? Was there a moment when you were working on this project and you thought, whoa, even I was not expecting that?
All of it. I mean, the Yankees are the KGB. They are the Kremlin. And because Cash trusted my co-writer, Bob Clappish, he let us in the door. And once we got in the door, we got all the way into the point that one of their senior executives said, look, you're already into the bank vault. We can't toss you out now. But if you promise to be fair and you promise to be kind, we will show you the secret documents. And they did. And neither Clappish and I could believe our eyes when we got all the way in and saw the way that this extraordinary, you know, world famous, you know, the world's most iconic sports brand actually does business. An amazing, amazing experience and a pleasure to write and report.
Honestly, Paul, I can't even believe what I'm hearing. When you consider the Yankees, they do such an amazing job of keeping things quiet, keeping their secrets. The fact that you and Clappish were able to get inside and past all that really is stunning. I mean, it's breathtaking. This book is called Inside the Empire, The True Power Behind the New York Yankees. The book is out today. The co-author is a best-selling author, Paul Solotaroff. Paul, we got to do this more often. I can't wait for the next project you work on. Congrats on this, and so good to have you back on the show.
My great pleasure, Jim. Best of luck.
You know, honestly, it takes more than hard work to make it to the pros. It also takes smarts. The kind of smarts that you can read. The kind of smarts that can read a defense and pick it apart. Hiring is no different. You need smarts to find the right people. But you don't need to spend years honing your game. You simply need ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes to find people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. Try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/clones. ZipRecruiter.com/CLONES. ZipRecruiter truly is the smartest way to hire. We go to Southfield right now. Jeff in Southfield. Jeff, how are you? What's up?
Thank you for the vine, Jim. Put on your seatbelts, clones, while I take you on my road trip. As I leave my home state of Michigan, I am greeted by a road sign that says, "Welcome to Indiana, the crossroads of America." Sounds like Indiana knows that no one wants to stay there. I took the sign's advice and kept going on to the next state. Soon I was greeted by a road sign that said, "Welcome to Wisconsin, where every high school quarterback looks like Jared Lorenzen." I looked at a map of Milwaukee and discovered that while some cities have districts, like a financial district or a theater district, Milwaukee has an all-you-can-eat buffet district. I thought, what better way to experience Wisconsin than to make a gluttonous pig of myself? So I headed straight there. But upon arriving, my excitement turned to confusion. All of the streets were empty. All of the windows were boarded up. And door after door after door all had the same sign. But that sign didn't say, out of business. It said, Eaton, out of business. As I walked back to my car, I noticed the ground beneath my feet felt more compressed than normal ground. The forensic evidence was undeniable, Jim. Wisconsin is fat. But what do you expect from a state that has given up literature, science, and the arts for cheese production, cheese consumption, and cheese-related fashion? And the worst kind of cheese, too. Jim, I'm proud to be an American, but I'm not proud of that cheap crap we call American cheese. Not only is American cheese not worthy of having its slices individually wrapped, its outer wrap should be a clown suit. It's the Bozo of cheeses. The number of Europeans whose vacation to America includes wanting the freshest sample of our American cheese is none. When the other cheeses have a party, American cheese sits home uninvited and eats a whole pack of itself from depression. Let's face it, the only thing American cheese is good for is drowning out the cheap taste of fast food hamburgers. upon considering that the state that has the cows for making cheese is also making the burgers, I realized what Wisconsin truly is. Clones, Wisconsin is the bubbling fountain that produces the raging river that is McDonald's. Thanks a lot, Wisconsin. Before leaving Wisconsin, I decided to go to McDonald's, figuring it might taste better closer to its source. I walked in and ordered a Big Mac, but they just looked at me with confusion. They didn't know what a Big Mac was. In Wisconsin, they just call it a Mac. As I headed home, I was greeted by a road sign that said, "Welcome to Michigan, the winter wonderland." We call it that because every winter we wonder why the hell we live here. That's a wrap, Jim. War, smack off, 25, fever. Brad versus the field, my ass.
Jeff in Southfield. Man, my man. He is a kook. Go ahead and rack that call. That American cheese bit.
You've got real tax questions, so TurboTax Live has real tax professionals who can answer them for you. They have CPAs and EAs who are on demand, ready to give you advice and answer questions as you go. Their tax pros get to know you so they can offer personalized suggestions and find all the deductions that you deserve. Whether you're stuck on a specific question or need guidance working through your return, their tax experts can give you the confidence to ensure that your return is done right. TurboTax Live with CPAs and EAs on demand. See details at TurboTax.com. That's TurboTax.com.
We are joined by Buzz Williams. Buzz, it is great to have you back. How are you, Buzz?
I'm doing great. Thank you so much for asking me to be on. How you doing?
Buzz, I'm doing great, and I really appreciate you making time for it. I know it's a really busy week. So let me start here, Buzz. You're taking the program to the Sweet 16 for the first time in more than a half century. Buzz, I know you. You'll be the first one to say you're not doing it. Virginia Tech basketball is doing it. Everybody involved in Virginia Tech basketball is doing it. So I'll pose the question this way. What's it mean to you and everybody in that program to be in this spot?
We're just all overwhelmed with gratefulness. I think to have tried to predict something like this would have been foolish, but to have the opportunity to live it in real life is, I'm overwhelmed. Overwhelmed with humility, overwhelmed with gratefulness. There's so many lessons for all of us to learn from this experience, and to have the opportunity to learn those lessons, it's very gratifying.
Buzz Williams joining us. You know, Buzz, when you took that job, the rap was, it's a football school. You cannot have basketball success there. You and I actually talked about that at that time, but you had a vision. How does it feel then to see that vision take shape and then become a reality?
Yeah, I think the success the football team has had here over the last 24 years speaks for itself. What Coach Beamer's in the Hall of Fame, I think he was inducted as soon as you could be inducted. I think the job that Coach Fuente has done is remarkable considering the legend that he replaced. I think anytime there is success or failure, there's not necessarily one person or one reason. It's always a multitude of things. And for me to simplify it to one category, Rome, I think it's just been the people. It's been our president, Dr. Sands. It's been our AD, Whip Babcock. It's been his administrative staff that has been so willing to go outside of their normal responsibility to help us. But it's been all of us. And I don't think it's just necessarily this year's team or this year's staff. I think it's been all of the players and all of the staff members who've been a part of building this from where it was, like Ahmed said the other night after the game, from 2-16 to the Sweet 16 during Ahmed's career. And that's not one person or one event. That's a lot of people pulling in the same direction. And for us to have predicted it would have been foolish, but for us to be able to do it is really, really cool.
Virginia Tech head basketball coach Buzz Williams joining us. I'm glad you mentioned Ahmed. I was going to ask you about him. He had 14 in that win against Liberty. And Buzz, he said after the win, and I quote, "I'm just excited to be able to play again with these guys. I'm a senior, and just all the work that has been put into the program just seems to be pouring out," end quote. So how happy are you to see him have a season like this and to see all that work paying off?
Yeah, it's so awesome Med's evolution as a person and as a player. He's going to have his master's degree in about 90 to 100 days. Single-parent household, youngest child in the household. For sure the most respected player by his peers that in my career as a head coach I've ever seen. Comes from absolutely nothing and has earned everything that has come his way. Low ego, high emotional intelligence, not scared to work. And for him to have been a part, like you said, you know, he played in year one when we finished in last place. He redshirted the next year. He had surgery. We didn't have to redshirt him, but I thought exchanging his fifth year for his second year was a good exchange. I also thought that if he was able to stay on track academically, which I knew his mom was going to help ensure that he did, he would have an opportunity to get his graduate degree. So it's all played out in such a really neat way for Ahmed, for his family, and for him to be a part of our program. He's been an integral part from the beginning to today.
We're talking to Buzz Williams. Now, Buzz, you're not just advancing to the Sweet 16. You're going there to face Duke in Washington, D.C. I know there are a lot of Hokie fans who are fired up about that matchup and that location. How does it sound to you?
Yeah, perfect. They're the number one team in the country. They're the number one seed in the tournament. They have the number one player in the country and probably number two and three as well. They have the number one coach ever in the history of college basketball. We are excited. I think there'll be more Hokie fans there than were in San Jose. I know Hokies are everywhere, but it'll be a little easier for more of us to get there. I hate that the prices of the tickets are going so high, but that's not because of the Hokies. That's because of the Blue Devils. But it'll be a great experience, and I think the ambiance and the environment will be dramatically different than what it was in San Jose. And I thought it was great out there.
Buzz Williams is my guest. Now, Buzz, you beat Duke earlier this season. They didn't have Zion Williamson, but you didn't have Justin Robinson. When you initially lost Robinson to injury, that's the kind of thing that can completely derail a season. And as you've talked about, it was not comfortable at first, but what did you and your players learn about this team when you were forced to play without Robinson?
Well, we were on the way to the CBI, or the CIT, if you follow Twitter. We missed 10 regular season games, so over half of the ACC play, and then obviously he did not play in the two games, Rome, that we were able to play in the ACC tournament. You know, it's like anything else in life. I think how you react in difficult situations, difficult circumstances, it's always a litmus test of your character. And I think the character of our kids and how their parents have raised them, we missed five. Five makes the game easier for me. Five makes the game easier for Ahmed, for KJ, for Nikhil. But it was a test. And I don't know that anyone could have predicted how well we did it during those 12 games. Five of them were on the road, I believe, and then two of them were neutral site. For us to do what we were able to do just speaks to the character of our staff, but also mostly, I think, our players.
Now, Buzz, in the open, I mentioned that you had a role as a floor sweeper and a sock washer at Navarro College, and you did that for Coach.
I'm still real good at it, Rome.
Yeah, of course. You don't forget that stuff. You don't forget that stuff. They can't teach that stuff, Buzz. You don't forget that stuff. Of course you are. Yeah. You're five-star at that stuff. Listen, you did that, though, for Coach Lewis Orr, and you had him with you in San Jose this weekend, as he has been every March Madness. What's it like to share this experience with him?
You know, I think in many respects, whether you're a high school coach or a middle school coach or Division III assistant coach, in my opinion, I think coaches are, in many respects, the last bastion of hope. And what Coach Orr has meant to my life as a future husband and a future father is so much more than I can articulate in an interview. And as a junior college manager, it wasn't as if my paradigm, Rome, was big enough that I understood, you know, someday I'm going to be the coach here and you're still going to be my guy. It wasn't that whatsoever. It was me making sure kids went to class. It was me, as soon as I got through with my classes, going to ask Coach Orr what it was I could do to help him that day. He turned 82 last week, and in my head coaching career, have been overly blessed. Our games in San Jose, Rome, were games number 16 and 17 in the NCAA tournament. And the only two people that have been at every one of those games have been my wife and coach. Mm. And for him to be able to be out there, obviously everyone in our program has known Coach no matter where I've been employed, but everyone here knows the impact that he has had on my life. And so I'm sure you have to go to commercial, but we beat Liberty, and we're coming back to the hotel. And, of course, the time change and just the emotion and all of it. I always like to kind of chatter at Coach and say some of the things that he would say to me when I was 17 and 18 working for him. And I said, Coach, I know you're tired and you need to get to bed, but, you know, that was a pretty big win. I said, why don't you just get on the plane with us and fly back to Virginia? You're too old to fly back commercially and too soft to do that anymore. And he goes, I was sure hoping you would ask. I go, yep, you're riding with me. And then you can stay with us on the way to D.C. So Coach is still with us right now, so he'll be at the game on Friday.
What a great story, Buzz. Buzz Williams is the head coach of Virginia Tech, and he recorded his 100th win at Virginia Tech on Sunday. Next challenge versus Duke, Friday night, CBS, 9:39 p.m. Eastern. Virginia Tech on the Sweet 16 for the first time in a half century. Buzz, I could do this all day long, but I really appreciate you as always. Thanks for making time. Good luck Friday night, and you know we'll be watching.
Rome, thank you so much. Please tell Coach Sampson I said hello and congratulations.
Reported last year that the average age of a baseball fan is 57. It's Time Magazine. Man, how rich is that? Time Magazine pointing out how old baseball fans are. Boy, that's the pot calling the kettle black. There's Time Magazine calling somebody old. That's rich as hell. But the problem for baseball is that that 57-year-old that Time Magazine was talking about last year is now 58. And the average age of a baseball fan is not staying the same, and it sure as hell is not going down. So, I guess you could wait for these geriatrics to age out. But that's not good if you've got nobody to replace them with, nobody younger to replace them with. So what's baseball supposed to do? Because pitch clocks and automatic intentional walks have yet to capture the hearts and minds of that highly coveted millennial demographic. Luckily for baseball, there is a solution to the problem, and it's coming from one of their own. It's coming from incredibly forward-thinking shortstop Elvis Andrus of the Texas Rangers. He may have single-handedly saved what used to be America's pastime last night without, I don't think, even intending to do so. Maybe he did. Maybe I'm not giving him enough credit, but it seems to me like it was coincidental and not intentional. During a spring training game yesterday against the Indians, Andrus comes to the plate, and he breaks out a brand new walk-up song. And not just any walk-up song. The walk-up song that has been played 3 billion times. B, with a B, billion. On YouTube, the song has its own wiki page. If you've never heard it, then either you're not a toddler or you're not the parent of a toddler. My man walked up on this. Andrus.
I don't see how that can't be great. People are going to love that.
Yep, I think you stay there with it. We'll see what happens on Thursday.
All right, so that had to trigger a lot of different things for a lot of you, right? Forget about the millennials. Man, go straight for Gen Z. Baby freaking shark, if you need it. And again, if you haven't heard that track, just Google it. It's the biggest song in the world by a landslide because it is straight up audio crack for toddlers. And if you've got a kid between the age of 2 and 7, then you know that you can bump Baby Shark even during the worst meltdowns, and they'll instantly snap too. It's sonic heroin. However, the trade-off for a well-behaved and happy kid is a freaking earworm of a song stuck in your head for the rest of time. But I think most parents will tell you it's worth it. 3 billion spins on YouTube. Many hundreds of millions more on Spotify and Apple Music would suggest just that. And Elvis Andrews is here to capture the attention of your screaming kids one bat at a time. It's genius. Baseball should thank him for it. Only problem that I can see is, you know when you give a toddler something and you give him a taste and you let him have it, but then you rip it from him, you take it away, the gates of hell open up. And Andrews can only get up 3 to 5 times a game. So it could backfire, especially since those at-bats come once every hour or so. Have you ever asked a toddler to wait an hour for something they have to have? You're taking life into your own hands. So what that means to me is the rest of the Rangers lineup has got to get on board. They need to turn their games into a pseudo kids bop concert every bottom half of the inning. I'm talking all 9 guys with their own toddler jam banging from the loudspeakers whenever they leave that on deck circle. And if you're wondering what that might sound like, you're in luck. I've enlisted the father of many, many toddlers. A father you all know, a father you all respect, the father of many toddlers, to curate a 9-song playlist for the Rangers starting lineup. We're doing the work for them. And not only are we doing work, I'm talking about a dad that you all know and respect, handpicking the music for every player. He also voiced their walk-up. I think by now you know who I'm talking about. The guy who has experience as the Cleveland Cavalier play-by-play announcer. The guy who has experience as a father because he has many, 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 many freaking kids. There is nobody better than our very own Alvin DeLauro to show the world exactly what the Rangers at-bats could sound like if they follow Elvis Andrews' lead. Alvy?
Batting first for your Texas Rangers designated hitter, Shinsu Chu. Batting second baseman, Rootman Ogun. Batting third, a shortstop, Elvis Andrews. Batting fourth, right fielder, Nomar Mazara. Batting fifth, left fielder, Joey Gallo. Batting sixth, the third baseman, Azdrubal Cabrera. Batting seventh, first baseman, Ronald Guzman. Batting eighth, the catcher, Jeff Mathis. Batting ninth, center fielder, Delino DeShields.
Alvy, thank you for doing your part to make our national pastime younger. Well done, Alvy. Especially that voiceover. That's all we have to do, right? If parents knew that that's what they were going to get when they went to the yard, you think they'd bring their kids? You think the toddlers would be there? And if they brought their toddlers, what would that do for the average age of a person watching baseball? I think Elvis Andrews is onto something. Now suck it up, man up, follow his lead. Do the right thing. Change your walk-up music, starting with Baby Shark. Alvin DeLauro, dude, you never cease to amaze. The genius that is Alvin DeLauro. A major leaguer walked up on that. Man, that is one annoying tune. Elvis Andrews. Mommy Shark. Hey, listen, it's been a while now. But when we had babies, man, you do whatever the hell you can, right? To pacify them. But that, look, you don't want to. There's nothing worse than having a kid cry in the crib and ignoring the kid, but you have to, because if you keep slamming that pacifier in their mouth, they're going to show up to middle school with a pacifier in their face. You can't do that. At the same time, you do what you can, right, to get the peace. Haunted 00 Horse tweets, baby shark, kill me now, Jim. I don't know, Horace, do you have a kid? Did it work? Have you ever dropped the shark on the kid? It works, right? Whatever it takes. Back in the day, we used to go with Baby Einstein. Baby Einstein worked really well back in the day. Chris No Longer in St. Pete tweets, as a parent of a near toddler age kid, baby shark is burned into my brain, and it hasn't gotten old yet. Fake K. Winslow, we heartily approve baseball players using Baby Shark as walk-up music. Signed, stay-at-home dads. At 512 Lumber, Baby Shark is my jam too, and I'm 57 years old. Signed, Coach McElwain. At Dan in Louisville, Great White Shark, do-do-do-do-do. Great White Shark, do-do-do-do-do. Signed, Bison Daley. Do I have to do this again? It's a moratorium on Bison Daley references of any kind. If you mention Bison Daley, who I used to interview on this show and I love talking to him, you're banned from the program in any way, shape, or form. I can't stop you from tweeting because I don't block anybody on Twitter. So I guess if you have to do that, but you can't call and you can't email. Hawk, mental note. Bison Daley, moratorium. You can turn that off anytime, Albie. But if you're the parent of a toddler, you know it works. Elvis Andrews knows. That's why he went up there with that. I really don't think there was anything ironic about that. I think he knew. I think that Elvis Andrews went to the game and thought to himself, you know what, man, I'm really sick of 98-year-old people coming to watch me play. I need younger people in the stands. I know. I'll walk up to Baby Shark. Yo, DJ Rome, way to go. You dropped that Baby Shark track on my drums, and I immediately started sweating, looking around for the missing baby bottle or blanket. But the only problem is, I'm in the middle of the office, surrounded by grown men. Unwar the love-hate relationship all parents have with kids, music, and TV shows. Well, unless you're Amish. Jake in the 937. Hey, Jim, I already get enough Baby Shark. Once every 6 months. Regards, Jules Dentist. Tommy from NC. Wow, Tom, that's pretty fresh. A Jewel reset. Pretty original, too, Tom. When you need auto parts but you cannot get to a store, visit O'ReillyAuto.com. You can buy your parts online and pick them up in the O'Reilly Auto Parts store of your choice. No shipping costs, easy returns, and convenient pickup on your schedule. Shop your way for the parts that you need at O'ReillyAuto.com. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Better parts, better prices, every day. We are joined by Kelvin Sampson. Kelvin, so good to have you back. How are you today?
Jim, it's always a good be on with you. That means that we must be doing good.
Actually, Kelvin, you're doing really well. So take me back to Sunday night in Tulsa. The clock is winding down in your win over Ohio State. The Cougar fans were chanting, Sweet 16, Sweet 16. What did it mean, Kelvin, for you to hear that?
You know, it's such a surreal moment. But the thing I was thinking about most, right behind our bench was my wife, Karen, my daughter, Lauren, my daughter-in-law, Tanya, and my granddaughter, Maisie. And I just thought about how good this made them feel. You know, we do everything here as a family. My son sits right beside me on the bench. My starting backcourt from the 2002 Final Four team, Hollis Price and Quanis White, are sitting there as assistant coaches. You know, I've got so many special people that play significant roles on this program. But you know, you want to share those experiences with your family. You know, my mother and father passed away in 2014, and they went to every NCAA tournament game that I ever coached, and I thought about them too. But you know, an experience like that doesn't happen very often. I just heard you reference 35 years for this school. But it's, you know, you're proud of your players, you're happy for them, you're happy for their families. And that's the circle, you know, your family, your players' families. You go through the recruiting process and get them to believe in something and play for something bigger than themselves, and all of a sudden they accomplish it. And it's just a proud moment. Every coach that goes through it, I'm sure, feels appreciative, and I want to thank all the people that helped them get there.
Kelvin Sampson, my guest. Kelvin, I'm not at all surprised to hear you answer that question that way, because you and I have talked in the past. You are the son of a Hall of Fame high school coach in North Carolina, and whenever you talk about your team and your staff and your players, the word family continues to come up. You're not looking to build a program. You're looking to build a family. And you made it clear that you were looking at Houston not for great scorers, but you were looking for great teammates. Because before you can have a great team, you've got to have great teammates. So when you're evaluating players, what is it that lets you know whether or not somebody's going to be a good teammate?
You know, you try to get to their games early, watch how they warm up, how they react to their teammates. You know, are they givers? You know, we've created a society of entitlement with this culture that's in some of these programs in AAU, not all of them. Some of them are tremendous. The kid I have, my point guard, Galen Robinson, played for an AAU program here called Texas Pro, coached by Marlon Lowe. And he ran his AAU program a lot like a college program or a really good high school program that he held kids accountable. And so it was an easy evaluation for me with Galen. You can see how he was a leader the first time I saw him. You know, a lot of times when you go out recruiting, you know you've got to find a kid that's going to be your captain one day. I don't think you can develop a captain. I don't think you can designate someone as a captain. I think you have to recruit that, and that is an intangible, somebody that is worried about his teammates, patting them on the butt, getting them going. Kid misses a shot, he goes over and high-fives them and tells them that's okay. We'll get it back this next position, whatever it may be. But Galen had that. You know, he had that captain quality about him. And I can go down the list of every kid in our program. You can tell they're high-character kids. They care about winning more than they do statistics. And when you get those kids together, getting them to play for each other is not hard because they all want to win. They all want to win the right way.
Kelvin Sampson joining us. Now, Galen, for those who do not know, went to high school in Houston. He was recruited by other programs, but he signed with you. He said he believed in you. He believed in your vision. You know, you've had, Kelvin, so much success over the course of your career. You've been to Sweet 16s. You've been to the Final Four. But how much does it mean to be able to share that moment with players who have never experienced it?
What a great point, Jim. And that's what it's all about. You know, it's not about you. It's, you know, as a coach, you get talked about a lot and in different ways. But at the end of the day, that's not why you get into coaching. You mentioned Montana Tech. I had no idea about this level or getting paid or being on radio shows with Jim Rome. That was the furthest thing from my mind. I wanted to coach. I wanted to see guys improve. I wanted to give them something and see if we could make a good team and get them to play the right way and then go see them have success. And then as you got older, you realize the relationships you're building with those kids is what really makes it special. Seeing them go from being your players to being your friends. You know, I had some kids that played for me at Oklahoma drive from Norman in Oklahoma City to Tulsa just to see our team play. And, you know, talking with them after the game, texting with them on the way back on the way to the plane. you know, those are the moments that, that silent moments, moments that don't get talked about is that what makes coaches proud, what gives us substance, is the difference you can make in a young man's life.
Kelvin Sampson is the head coach of the Houston Cougars. They're on to the Sweet 16. You know, Kelvin, I want to mention Montana Tech one more time. You and I have talked about that in the past and your roots there. But now you're in a spot where from the outside, you appear to be having the time of your life. When you look back on the days of driving that van and taping players' ankles, and now when you look at where you are right now, what do you think and how special is that?
You know, Joe Castiglione, my athletic director at Oklahoma for about 9 years, when I first got the job at Houston, Jim, he sent me a painter's ladder. I mean, a 9-foot ladder. I mean, it came in the mail, for goodness sake. Somebody told me you have a package outside. I just thought it was a box. I said, well, go ahead and bring it in. He said, no, we you need to tell us where to put it. And I said, well, I said, for goodness sake, what is it? But he sent that ladder as a symbol of every step on that ladder, somebody is going to help you get to where you want to go. And when we won the conference championship this year, we used that ladder to cut down the nets. And I touched each step because I thought about the sacrifices my family's made, our academic people, our support services staff, our players' families, the custodians in the gym, the people that clean our offices, the managers. Everybody has a contribution that they make to have to you being successful. And that's what Montana Tech was for me. It was a start. You know, I think my first salary was about $16,000, and I thought I was the richest guy in the world. I had a second job as I cleaned apartments. I cleaned apartments when they were being vacated to get them ready for the next tenant to move in. So they let me stay rent-free. So you think about all the things you do when you get started and the sacrifices your family makes to allow you to chase your dream. Then when you get to a certain point, you automatically hit the rewind button to go back to that point. Because the one thing I try to teach our kids, Jim, is don't ever, ever forget where you come from. You're going to make mistakes. Nobody's perfect. Things not always going to go your way. But if you always have a reference point, and your reference point is how you got started, and go back to that point often. It'll bode you well as you go forward.
We're talking to Houston Cougars head coach Kelvin Sampson. Kelvin, I want to say one more thing, too. The program won 13 games back in 2015. You're on to the Sweet 16. I did have Buzz Williams on the show earlier this hour. He wanted to make sure that I said hello to you from him and congratulations to you from him. He's doing something very similar to you, but I want to make sure that I made that point for you. You know, I'm watching your team, and every team you've coached has played every possession like it was their last possession, but it seems like your Houston teams approach offense a little bit differently maybe than some of your teams in the past. How much of that comes from the time that you spent in the NBA?
All of it, Jim. All of it. I wish every college coach could take a sabbatical to step back for a year and just go be an observer. Just sit in the film rooms, go to practices, watch film on the other NBA teams. I love scouting Terry Stotts from Portland, Rick Carlisle from Dallas, Stan Van Gundy when he was at Orlando. I can go down the list. I learned so much just preparing our team for our next opponent and understanding – not just spacing, but how to maintain spacing, how to space and transition, how to play pick-and-roll basketball with the corners filled and lift to the slot. I didn't know about a lot of that stuff. I knew what spacing was, but I didn't understand it well enough to maintain it. We won, but we were winning with our defense and making sure our best player got most of the shots. But now, you know, if you look at our team play, we shoot the ball early in the shot clock if it's there. We give our guards a lot of freedom to go make plays for themselves and others. And it's a lot of fun to coach that way, and it's a lot of fun to watch, too.
It is. It is a lot of fun to watch. All right, Kelvin, so you're facing Kentucky next. Another great opportunity for you in the program. What is the biggest thing that jumps out to you as you watch film on Kentucky?
I'm going to say this, Jim, and I mean it with all sincerity. The thing that jumped out to me was – how well disciplined they were at both ends. Cal does not get enough credit for being an outstanding coach. he's coaching freshmen. Now, they're not freshmen anymore. They're 36 games into their career. It qualifies them some years as juniors. But this is a well-oiled defensive team. You know how hard it was to beat Wofford without their best player, P.J. Washington? How good those kids had to play. I watched that entire game yesterday. Wofford plays hard. I mean, they run their offense hard. And that hero, Higgins, Quigley, Baker, those kids were chasing them off those screens with great discipline. The bigs were helping on the screens, getting back to their men. The discipline that they had was amazing. I'm just really impressed with the job Cal's done with this team. It's definitely the best team we've played this year because of the balance front court and back court and their length. Now, we don't have great length in our back court. We're 6'1", 6'1", 6'3", and they're 6'3", 6'5", 6'6", 6'7", whatever they are. But those kids play hard. They're disciplined. And their big guys are really, really talented.
So, Kelvin, finally, what is your message to your team as they get ready for this great challenge? What are you telling them right now?
Keep that chip on your shoulder, guys. You know how we practice, how we play. Let's go be who we are.
He is the head basketball coach at the University of Houston, and they are on to the Sweet 16 again. For the first time in 35 years, he is a friend of the program, and you've got Houston and Kentucky on Friday night. Kelvin, great to see you back in the Sweet 16. Really nice to have you back on the show. Good luck on Friday night. We will all be watching.
Well, if you talk to Buzz again, tell him I appreciate him. He's a great friend, proud of him and proud of his program, too. And I appreciate you having me on, Jim.
Good night now!